This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. Ka-ching. Come on, guys, we talked about this. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. You want to grow big? Shopify. You want to grow small? Shopify. You want to grow medium rare? Also Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboy's Booksplode, Queen and Country Definitive Edition, Volume 1. Nobody does makes me feel sad.
Hello and welcome to the second iFanboy Booksplode. Booksplode is the show where we pick a volume of comic book and we talk about that book and in depth in a way that we haven't really been able to in any of our other shows. So this week we are going to be talking about Queen and Country Definitive Edition Volume 1. That's from Oni Press. The whole series is written by Greg Rucka. I am Josh Flanning and I'm here with other iFanboy staff writers, Paul Montgomery.
Hello.
Sonia Harris.
Hiya.
And Jim Mrochkowski.
Hey, everybody.
Hello. In case you aren't familiar with it, Queen and Country is a comic book series. It's a black and white indie series that came out originally in around 2000, 2001, I think. And what it is, it's a story about the British Special Service, MI6, as opposed to MI5, who does domestic, MI6 does international. They're the spies for the British government, and it focuses mostly on Tara Chase, who is a female agent who sort of made an appearance in Rucka's earlier work, Whiteout, but it's not really her. They didn't name her that for contractual reasons, something like that. But it's a fine series, and it ran sort of off and on for a while, and then it sort of concluded. But we're not going to talk about the later part of the series. We're going to talk about just the first volume, which is the first, I believe it's 12 issues. Is that
the first three storylines?
Yeah. Yeah, it's volumes 1 through 12, or issues 1 through 12. These little definitive books that came out, one of these, the first one I think was the Book of the Month a long, long time ago. And they're nice.
I can confirm that.
Yeah, they're a little bit smaller than regular trade paperback size in sort of dimensions, but they're nice and thick, and it's a good read and a good way to experience the book. And I think it's like $20 each. Yeah, $20 each.
Yeah.
So
and,
it's really beautiful. They're very, very elegantly designed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the size of it. I love the design of it. It looks like a paperback Stephen King novel that you might buy today. Like you could. If you were an embarrassed sort, you could read it on the train and not feel like you had to explain anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm. And with a lovely Tim Sale cover, I might add.
Yeah.
Let me ask, were any of you reading this in issues as it came out?
No. Nope.
Never.
Nope. I never liked the covers. I didn't like the
I didn't read it because of its reputation. Like, if the very first thing I read about a book is that I'll put out the next chapter sometime between now and 2011, I'm not going to set myself up for that.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, this is one of those books where it's like I hear Planetary is great, but number 27, you know, has been in the making since I was 14 years old, and I'm just not going to – when it's finished, I'll look at it. But in the meantime, why drive myself crazy?
So this is this has worked out for you, their program.
It's certainly – yeah, oh, absolutely.
Well, I read the book in issues from the beginning, from the first time it came out, because Greg Rucka is he's a hero of mine.
Yeah.
Every sense of the word. No, I was a big fan of Whiteout, and you know, Greg Rucka is one of those guys who I follow around, you know, no matter what. It's funny that you mentioned Planetary, because I read that for a while, and then I was like, I'm not buying it. It's late. But, Greg Rucka can do no wrong for me, so whenever he puts these out, I will buy them, and I'm totally cool with that. But we're not talking about that stuff later. We're just going to focus on these first 12 issues. So most of you guys are recent to this. You heard about the books after... Like, everybody said it was really good, I assume.
Yeah, you guys. Connor's Book of the Month thing drove it into my skull and broke me down. And I went, you know, all right, you vultures, I'll buy it.
See, for me, it was Mike Romo. We were at WonderCon a year and a half ago, and he said, you have to get this. It's really good, and look how pretty it is. Come on. He made me buy so much stuff at WonderCon a year and a half ago. It was about...
Are you finished reading all of it yet, or...?
I got to volume 3.
All right. No, I meant all the books that you bought that day. It was a joke.
That
a
day.
Stack joke.
A static joke.
I've got stuff
see.
That I... She's not awake yet. that's very clear.
Damn you, time zones.
So, Paul, you jumped on it. What were you thinking about the book when you first started reading it?
Well, this was one of those things, like, I'd seen the trades and had heard all these great things about it. And I kept putting it off. And then when they came out with the definitive editions, I was like, I have no more excuse to pick this up. So I grabbed it, and then it kind of sat on my shelf for a while because I was sort of intimidated by it. And then I said, well, we should do a booksplode on this. So that would force me to read it. And I'm really glad that we did get to read it and talk about it, because I'm really, really enjoying it. So I'm actually halfway into book 2. And looking forward to ordering the next ones. But I thought this was really cool, and I think it's interesting in terms of like presentation. There's even in this volume alone, there are 3 different artists for the 3 different storylines.
There certainly are.
And it's interesting to see how, you know, what part of the book. What part of the appreciation for the book is from just Rucka's writing, and what part of it, you know, is the art. So it's neat to actually have one story arc in one style and the next in another style. So you can sort of figure out how you feel about the story and what Rucka's doing.
Well, if you're going to switch artists, that's the way to do it, you know, in self-contained arcs. I'm a big fan of books like this, or I buy The Walking Dead in the largest possible volumes, you know, the ones that come out a year at a time, and I love getting my stories in these great big chunks. But reading this reminded me a bit of the very first volume of The Walking Dead hardcovers, which are Tony Moore art for the first half, and then jarringly not that for the next part. And you know, there's sort of this feeling of slamming on the brakes at one point when I was reading The Walking Dead. I've gotten used to it by now, and I probably would.
Exactly.
He's not going anywhere. You're with Charlie Adler from there right. on out. You get.
But that feeling of shock, that sudden, like, oh, okay, we're switching gears very quickly.
Right. But you're almost like, I wish I didn't like the first part of this so much.
Well, yep. You know, it's funny because it's interesting because, I mean, like, I read this in issues, and so each arc. And I think this works the whole way through. Every arc is a different artist on it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody repeats or anything. And so once you get used to that, it's the same thing that happens in Sandman or something like that. And
New Avengers,
yeah,
for that matter.
I've never seen Sandman physically change. And he wasn't even corporeal. I've never seen him change as radically as Leandro Fernandez had Tara Chase change.
Yeah,
she was an entirely different character.
They really take the rocket. They take the rocket train to Boobtown in chapter 3 of this.
I think we should table that and get to it near the end, because otherwise we're starting off on this foot.
Right.
So let's talk about the things we like for a little while.
Okay,
and then.
I just want to interject that I do like Leandro Fernandez's art. I don't want anyone to think I don't like him. It's just a radical change.
I understand. So the first story, let's keep going. Sonia, you picked it up a while back. Had you heard of it before that? Were you interested in it? Is it sound like your kind of thing?
Yeah, people were always saying I should read it. They'd say, "Oh, you'd like this. You should read this. It's about MI6. You'd read," because I like kind of like the Bourne identity, and I don't know, I figured because it's English, probably they thought I'd like it. I don't know, but I really didn't like
that. You should like this. It's American. I'd be like, well, that's everything.
Right. You know, right. People are fucking stupid. What can I say? Anyway, so they kept saying it, but I really, really had a problem with the font they used for the logo initially. So I never picked it up because I thought it looked awful because of that.
If there was anyone I knew who would say that,
yeah,
that wasn't Ron Richards, it would be.
Sorry.
I know
it's
like
ridiculous.
The logo.
Yeah.
Well, you're a design person.
Yeah. I just feel like it's, you know, the cover is there to tell you what's inside, and so I didn't look at it. Yeah, and actually I really enjoyed it. I mean, I once wrote this in a joking article, The Lost Ten Commandments of Comics, where I said that Americans shouldn't write English dialogue, and I was talking about this.
Really?
I actually never had a problem with Hellblazer, which was what you said at the time, is I think Sonya has a problem with Hellblazer, but I never did.
Many Americans have written it. Only Brian Azzarello and then Jason Aaron did a couple issues, and for most part, they've all been from the UK.
Hellblazer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. That's why I didn't say it about Hellblazer, but in the article, you responded to the comments to people and said, I think she means Hellblazer. But actually, I really like Brian Azzarello's writing on it. No, the problem I had is not with the way he writes dialogue. I think he's rocker, does a beautiful job.
There's definitely things where I was like, wow.
He uses phrases wrong.
Okay.
He uses a couple phrases again and again wrong, and it's so dumb because it doesn't matter. It's like the font, you know, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But it's that moment where it pulls me out of the suspension of disbelief. Yeah. He says, on your bike, and he doesn't use it to mean get out of here. He means it to go, oh, you're going somewhere. Nobody uses it that way. People only mean it in a nasty, like, yeah, fuck off.
I actually wrote that on the website last night, but I think I used it in the correct way.
I'm sure you did. And I'm sure he's learned since then. And he also says things like store. People don't usually say store in England. They much, much more often say shop. Store is more where you would store things.
To be fair, there's a lot of British writers writing American comics. I catch that stuff all the time.
Absolutely. It made me think about that a lot. Mm-hmm. But because I'm English and only partly American, I don't pick up on that as much.
So. Maybe Tara Chase is a trendsetter and she's trying to make On Your Bike happen. Did you ever think about that?
Well, it's not her. It's not. That's the problem.
No,
two different characters say it, so it's weird. It is just stupid. I know it's silly to get hung up on these tiny things.
Leave the micro alone and we back up a little more. You must like some of it.
I love Steve Ralston's art, first of all. And I love that he makes her feminine and vulnerable, but not weak or seductive in any way. She's just very much doing her job and living her life and having absolutely no idea how to live in a healthy way in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, for a woman who's at times been too involved in my work, my work is not nearly this stressful, not even a tenth as stressful.
you only feel like killing people.
Yeah. But I like what he does with the characters. I think it's amazing. He weaves a very nice, rich set of characters. Mm-hmm. And a very strong female character, which is fun. It's only in that last story that, because the art's so different, I actually can't tell if I even like the story, which is really a shame. It's strange departure from their behaviors of previous storylines, and she is very, very voluptuous and seductive in her movements. So it's hard to know if I actually like her or if I think she's an arrogant bitch suddenly.
I would say she's all of these things. Jim, do you have any tiny, tiny things about it that stop you from liking it?
No, and in fact, I think that if you're going to tell a story like this, where the Ralston art, I don't know that I've seen anything like it before or since. And I think it's a nice complement to a story that is equal parts sort of espionage, intrigue, and bureaucracy, to take something that's so, like, it could be such a Michael, should be such a Gaydos book or a Michael Lark book or a Sean Phillips book or something like that, and kind of use as a counterpoint a more cartoony style. I think. I don't know if you ever, as a kid, read The Nom from Marvel Comics, but they did kind of the same thing. Yeah. I would say it was Michael Goldman.
Michael Goldman.
They would take, you know, these gritty, real-life more real than real situations and put the most out kind of off the wall cartoon art on it. Not to say that the Ralston art is off the wall, but it's just more of a it's by kind of picking that artist that is sort of an unconventional choice for the subject matter, it ends up working beautifully, I think, rather than hamstringing it or anything like that.
Well, for me, this book, it's you bring that up, this is a huge influence for me, because like some of the stuff that I'm working on, like I always think I love. This is the book that showed me that you can use what is considered quote unquote cartoony art and put it with a completely story that's completely set in reality.
Yeah,
like there's no fantasy about it. It's like you use the word bureaucracy, and I think that's something that very much comes through. And so there are scenes that are just two men in suits talking in an office, and that is comic book anathema.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't happen, but mm-hmm. it actually works for the most part in these, which I always found very interesting. One of the things that I think that there's this book has three arcs. The first one is drawn by Steve Rolston, whose work you've seen in The Escapist. He draws a lot like
that's where I've seen it. Okay.
He draws a lot like Sonia. Who is it that I can't think of that I interviewed and you were right there last year? Drew the Grant Morrison book.
That's interesting. He a little bit like Philip Bond, but I wouldn't have said that. But now that you've said it a little bit,
it's
and maybe that's why
bit.
I like it so much.
Philip Bond drew the first issue of The Escapist, and Steve Rolston drew the rest of them, and most people didn't notice.
Oh, interesting.
See, I see a massive difference, but I've been following Bond's work since he first started.
But the two guys are very similar. You know, they hold similar places in the industry, I'd say. Anyway,
but if I could add one more, it looks a lot like Scott McCloud too in like Zot.
Really,
I think it's just very clean. I don't know. I think so. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I can see that. One of the things that worked really well because he used this cartoony style, this more. Like evocative, everybody was able to look different. By not making them look realistic, he could exaggerate the features on people so that you knew the difference between the two white, dark-haired guys, which would be Tom Wallace, who's Minder. Basically, by the way, the cast is basically four people for the most part. There's Tara Chase, Tom Wallace, and Ed Kittering. Ed's the first one, right? Those are the three Minders, and those are like the main... Mm-hmm. James Bond go out there, shoot people, spies, and then their boss, Paul Crocker. There's other people around, but those are sort of the main characters. Now, Tom Wallace...
But I don't find it cartoony.
Okay.
I just object to that term, and I know that at the end there's some sketchbook stuff that's like people were complaining it was too cartoony, but I think they look like real people, just... Yeah, I think they look really like... You can feel their personality coming through. It's just...
There's something about the line, though, that I can't quite put
But I mean, it's again mentioning Scott McCloud. Like basically, it's about being photorealistic or about being there's a word I can't think of that
like expressionistic.
Expressionistic. It's telling you what is there using much less lines and being much less realistic. And that's how I describe this kind of work. That's why I don't like the word cartoony because it evokes a lot of other things. But it's a single line. It's not shaded. It's it's slightly caricature-ish. And in that sense, this book is really. Good because it lets you know who all these characters are in a very succinct and quick way.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of books, a lot of comic book artists can't draw dark-haired white men to look any different from one another. And in this,
I was thinking
have facial features.
Yeah.
And
if Mike Diodato had written Operation Broken Ground, we just wouldn't be talking about this book at all, right?
No, we wouldn't, because it would have been like, you mean the one with Tommy Lee Jones versus Tommy Lee Jones versus Tommy Lee Jones?
Right.
That he's probably better than that.
He might have worked a Gene Hackman in there.
Maybe. Does he use Gene Hackman?
I don't. God, I hope so.
Oh.
Idea.
And then so you get to – and what I think that does is it establishes who these people are really well from the beginning. His character designs, which pretty much hold throughout the rest of the book, it works in that way, and I really like that. And then so when you switch to the next artist, which is Brian Hurt, it's a little bit different, but it's sort of working in that same school, and he pretty much uses the same model, and it works the same way. Brian Hurt, a lot of people might know from – I know him from doing The Damned, also from Oni, sort of a horror noir book, and then he also did Hard Time for a while by the late Steve Gerber.
Yeah.
And it's funny because to me, I didn't find it jarring when new artists came on this book because I like – these are – and this might be because of this book, but these are the kind of comic book artists that I like best. They're cartoonists more in the vein of like a Will Eisner, as sure. opposed to, you know, what's popular at Marvel, the Mike Diodato or the other stuff I don't like as much, I suppose. But also, like, even like, you know, it's not like the Ethan Van Sciver school either. It's not that traditional stuff.
Brian Lee O'Malley inks something in this, doesn't he?
He's the second. Yeah, the first story and the second in the Brian Hurt stuff. He also lettered some of it, I think, at some point. Maybe not this book. Maybe that was a different book. Maybe he lettered local, and I'm completely confused. One of the things that I think I really liked about this was, and I'm sorry that Sonya has to be here while I do this, but I'm like a British culture fetishist in a way. And like, this is, I don't know if you know, but this is based on a show, loosely based on a show called The Sandbaggers. And if you've ever seen The Sandbaggers, it's a regional British television show from the 70s. And it's literally like watching this book. I mean, literally.
I only found that out when I was doing research an hour ago, so that I knew I would have more than three things to add.
Did you happen to check it up on YouTube or anything?
No, I didn't get that far.
Oh my God. I mean, Tara Chase isn't in. There isn't a Tara Chase character in that. There's a female spy who comes on later, but the main guy is basically Paul Crocker, a character who I love mm-hmm. very much, you know, with all my heart. In fact, I enjoy his work a lot more. I enjoy like his scenes a lot more than Tara Chase's, because he's that interesting, like, he's put upon all the
just
time,
just angry all the time.
Angry, but he's also like, he's got the very best of intentions at heart, actually. Yeah. And I like that, because no one likes him and he's an asshole, but like, he really is trying to do the right thing all the time. Mm. And you know, he's getting stepped on by the, I love the bureaucracy of the whole book, and there's nothing like British bureaucracy when it comes to,
yeah,
you know, I've worked at a couple of companies that, you know, you have that down.
I was thinking that, because I was thinking how much I enjoy the scenes where they're arguing politics. The head guys are all arguing, well, if we inform the government of this, then we might not be able to do that. Oh, they already know about this. We're not going to get away with that. It's very funny.
That was the part of it that I found most interesting, when it turned out not to so much be the Bourne identity as it turned out to be, you know. It had less to do with James Bond than it did with The Office.
Yeah.
In some respects, in terms of...
Yeah, you know, people said that to me once about Battlestar Galactica. Oh, it's like The Office in space. And I'm like, that's the most interesting stuff, is the grown-ups deciding who's going to live and who's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what I like about this. It's a comic book about some adults doing adult jobs.
Very much so, and I think that this
Which is not to say that rocket launchers don't get fired at the embassy.
And it's funny, because this is my favorite thing that Greg Rucka has ever done, because this is exactly where he should be and wants to be. Like, he can do superhero stuff, and people say, oh, I really like Checkmate, and I did too, but it is a version of this that has been stuffed into superhero tights to a certain extent, and it has to work within the confines of the DC universe. And here, he only has to work within the confines of relative reality. You know, where he's got to make it seem, and it's funny, because, you know, Sonya, you picked up that he's trying to make it a little more authentically British, but from my perspective, and this is, you know, not completely removed, because I've worked for British companies for probably 7 years straight, and so I'm very familiar with it. Like, I was like, he's doing a pretty good job with this for a guy who lives on the west coast of the U.S. You know what I mean? I began to wonder. I was like, did he spend time in London? And then I realized he was just working off of the Sandbaggers, basically.
He does a very good job, yeah. I think.
You know, in tone, even more so than maybe the specifics of language. One of the other things I really enjoyed is that with so much action stuff out there, you know, the hero goes in, they shoot the bad guys, they do whatever, and those scenes are in here. But afterwards, you see somebody who appears to be tough as nails, and that is actually breaking her. That doesn't sound like a new story, but I feel like it's a new story for comic books. It's not the kind of thing that normally gets tackled in these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't see Captain America after a big battle break down.
No. That's not his shtick, though. But you do see it sometimes. I don't know. Batman's a big one for having feelings.
I've always thought that if you took just the bullet points from Spider-Man's life, he would be a psychotic mental case for the rest of his entire the Gwen incident alone.
Daredevil's another one who's always crying. Yeah. Right. They have feelings.
Everyone who tries to kill Spider-Man turns out to be his neighbor or someone he knows.
People that know me are always trying to kill me. Yeah, I know how you feel.
Deeply paranoid.
Maybe the difference here is that Tara doesn't have anybody to show any of that to.
Right. Also, like she has no family, and it's the nature of the job to a certain extent. True. But
yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, she's really isolated. She doesn't know how to live. She doesn't know how. Like, being functional in the world is work. You need to make it function. But then, and she doesn't know how to make it work.
But to every single other person in the world, she appears completely confident. And so, like, there's no – and also she's not getting anything for this. A superhero there's, like, an ego boost. You have superpowers. You get to do things. She's – like you really begin to question, like, why would you be a spy? There's no – you don't get paid a lot. There's no recognition in the end of it. Most of you die.
But there's that moment where she does some good in the end of the second volume, and she feels good. There's just a tiny hint of a smile on her face, and you understand that this is all she has. This is the only thing she has to give her some depth and meaning in her life.
Mm-hmm. And I like that they really didn't like boldface and underline that. It's a little small moment. It's all you need to know that she got some kind of satisfaction out of that and moved on. And it's the next day and what's next and everything like that. It's it's not overly sentimentalized, but it's not just, you know, cold and this is what we do. There's a little there's just enough of the human element in it to keep it going. Mm-hmm. And keep you caring about the characters.
Well, what are some of the things that you guys picked up on specifically that you really liked?
You'll have to edit that pause out.
I know.
It's being polite and letting each other go first.
Right. Maybe it's because I'm a little – I mean I view everything through the American lens. But I was very interested to see how they interacted bureaucratically with the American spies. Lots of meetings on park benches and like –
it's very romantic.
Right.
It is.
Sharing an umbrella.
Being politely told, no, you can't go on your operation because, you know, it jeopardizes one of ours, and having to sort of haggle it out a little bit. That was one of the things that even when the first time I read this book was quite some time ago, so I needed to freshen my brain up a little bit to participate. And that was one of the things that was still sticking in my mind a few months later, like seeing these people, the classic microfilm exchange on the park bench, except most of it is just spent sort of bickering about what they can and can't do without getting in one another's way.
While avoiding eye contact.
Right, the whole time.
I really love that. Like the fact that every time you see Crocker, who is basically the head of operations, or D-op, and then he meets with the CIA contact, Angela Cheng, a female Asian, which I thought was an interesting choice as well, to sort of represent the American side on this side of the book, and they just never look at one another. They always have to draw the body language so that they're right. You know, from a distance, they look like they're not with each other.
Which, from a practical standpoint, as someone who knows nothing about spying, that's not fooling anybody.
No.
When's the last time you were in a park and you sat down on a bench next to someone you'd never met before?
You don't live in New York City. Well, you also don't live in London, so it's probably a little more crowded than maybe.
Bloody hell, yeah. Yeah, I like that. Actually, that is sort of feels English a lot of the time. That's enjoyable. But more than that, I think he's created a convincingly non-American woman, at least in the first two stories. I felt like she was very non-American, because that's one of the things I notice. Not to be funny here, but American women glam it up a lot and wear a lot more makeup and have the shiny hair going on all the time. And I think in England, I don't know why it is, but I've just found that my personal experience of my female friends in England is that they're just a bit more normal.
Yeah, but they're not exactly the ones showing up on Big Brother, are they? I mean, it's not like there's a shortage of tarts over there. You know,
exactly. But, you know, I would imagine a woman with a job as demanding as that doesn't spend all her time with a hairdryer and a ton of makeup fucking about. Like, it's not going to be convenient.
Have that job. I mean, just, you know, sorry.
Don't do that, please.
No, but by that same token, so it was.
She feels real. That's what I'm saying.
That's true.
It was interesting when we get to the part in the book. Oh no, that's volume two. Never mind.
You read ahead.
Silence.
Boy. Oh,
Well, because I immediately picked up volume two and was reading it afterwards.
I did that, but this time I just reread volume one just to get straight with what was in what book. And I just, again, really gravitate to the way Ralston draws her as this really normal woman just trying to get on with doing her job well.
Well, let's get back to the giant long-nosed elephant in the room. The thing that everybody keeps wanting to bring up is the third arc is drawn by Leandro Fernandez, a guy who at the time I had never heard of. This was the first time that I ever saw his work. He since went on to do a lot more mainstream work. I think he worked he did Wolverine with Rucka after Derek Robertson left that book. And it looked very different than what his work looks like here. So Sonia, you were the most obviously affected by it.
She's just she looks super heroic. And it takes away from the reality of the book. Even though the other artists are supposedly more cartoony, she moves, all of the characters, as you say, their body language is well drawn. But when Leandro starts drawing her, she has that way of standing like a superhero where her chest is puffed out and she's holding all her breath in her chest and her waist is very tiny and she's always flexing her shoulder muscles. And it works very well for a superhero. And I think it detracts a little bit from the basic nature of this particular book.
I've got to say, I'm actually flipping through these pages right now, though, and I don't see that often. I mean, maybe like in the beginning. The problem is the very first scene with Tara Chase is she's got like a thong on and her shirt's open. And so like that's the first thing you see. And so after that, you tend to look for it. But
but
really
the way she stands, her waist is so small. And she wears a shiny T-shirt at one point, and she's just got tremendously big boobs.
Yeah, she was wearing like a mesh shirt at one point.
Yeah.
You see like the bra underneath. She has the figure of like a clip-on bow tie. Like that, like it's really kind of jarring. And you know, more than just, you know, thinking that this is kind of slightly offensive, it sort of was and wasn't appropriate to the storyline because it was about sort of her, you know, romantic relationship with one of the other characters, and it over-sexualized her, and I would have liked to see what that same story would have looked like with the Ralston art, where she sort of has like a more prominent nose, and she looks more like a regular person. Mm-hmm. And
you know what, the thing that Sonia's talking about and that you are too, really, it's much more apparent in the first two issues.
Yes.
And so if you look, I'm wondering if he got notes at some point, like, hey,
oh, he got notes.
You need to tone it down. Because
there's one point where I clearly figured, okay, Rucka in the script wrote, she wears an oversized knit sweater.
Right.
Because
right. It's also possible from what I've heard of this book that it just took so long for the next one to come out that he forgot how he'd been drawing her.
Listen, buddy, I read them all along. They were fine. Jesus.
Okay.
It was only at one point later, but there was 52.
All I know is that if I'm noticing a female character's lips, then something,
yeah,
especially Tara Chase's
mouth.
Lips, then something has probably gone wrong. Although, frankly, yeah. Of the two, I would have been happier if Tara Chase had stayed however he wanted to draw her and Crocker had not turned into one of the blue meanies from Yellow Submarine.
Now, that was the first thing that I noticed, was I didn't notice Tara Chase as much as I noticed that Crocker's nose became ridiculous.
Now, yeah.
The thing about that is, I've been back, I've read this a couple of times. I don't mind it. And I know that like it affected a lot of people. It probably affected me the first time I read it, and I didn't really like it at first. But going through it now, the storytelling in these is really good, and the page layouts and the composition of these pages are all a lot more dynamic than what had come from earlier in the book. And which is because there's a lot of A, romantic scenes, and B, action scenes in this stuff.
Yeah, I
think he does action much better.
Absolutely. And his blacks, and you know, like he's using those black and white pages in a way that the other guys didn't at all.
See, I don't know if better or more dramatically. It's just a more dramatic book suddenly.
Well, you know, but see, that fits along with it to me. Because the one thing is we see different sides of Tara, for example. So it sort of makes sense to me that she could be drawn in different ways depending on what the things is. I think that
Mind of One's actually in the field.
Yeah. I mean, were she to you know, dress up and decide to be sexy, she would probably look pretty ridiculously gorgeous. You know what I mean? So it sort of depends on how she wants to carry herself. And if I'm just looking.
But why would she suddenly change like that? That's like, you know, that'd be weird. People change gradually over time.
She's a spy.
You don't suddenly go to work dressed like an entirely different person, different hair.
I guess what I'm saying.
This is so early too. It's this is only the third storyline she's been in. So, I mean, it's not. I guess it's not that drastic.
The thing is, it didn't bother me that much. The
stylistically, it's drastic.
Really
but...
strong, right? But even that was toned down. Like,
yeah,
the
writing really changed.
I got used to it. Like, I got used to the Paul Crocker nose, and I was like, oh, he's just being expressionistic about things. And I was kind of okay with that because at the end of the day, the pages are actually really good. If you hadn't read the stuff before, you wouldn't know the difference.
Right. If you were just coming in cold to chapter 3 or whatever it was, you wouldn't necessarily mind one way or the other. I'll agree with that.
And some of the really fun stuff about this is like the sort of weird budding romance and the awkwardness between Tara and Ed, I think is done really well in this, at least from a writing standpoint as well. The scenes in the dark offices with Crocker getting in arguments are beautiful. Mm-hmm. I would consider myself a Leandro Fernandez fan, but I wasn't at first. You know what I mean? Like, it grew on me. And besides the fact that at the end of the story, they just go back to somebody else. Everybody's got preferences, I suppose.
Right.
And drawing somebody off model for a little while is vaguely forgivable.
Feeling is if it's like someone said, oh, I'm going to be working on Superman this year. I think I'll draw him with a shorty cape and little hot pants.
Maybe, when Jack Kirby went to DC and they hated the way that he drew Superman, it's all, they chose this guy for his style. Some people don't like his style.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's what you get. I mean, I get what I'm saying is the first time I read it, I was totally down with you. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with Crocker's nose? Having been through it now 2-3 times, I do see the merits of these pages in addition to the other things that are wrong with it. And for me, like, it doesn't take away from it all that much.
Okay, here's the problem. It's the same problem I had with the, and maybe it's because I like to buy into a story. I like to lose myself in a story. Just like the language things, it's a small thing. I actually like the art. I like the artist and what he does. But it's such a drastic switch that it pulls me out of the story a little bit. It reminds me that I'm just reading a story, that it isn't real.
Sure. But we all have different levels of that.
That's the problem I have with it. Yeah.
You know, did that last through the storyline? Like, did you... the whole time, was it just jarring, or did you, get used to it?
I was okay with it.
Who did that?
I got used to it, but it wasn't as enjoyable as the rest of it had been.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Some people probably don't like Brian Hurt, so, after Steve Rolston. But I thought that story-wise, it progressed really very nicely. I was actually surprised how much stuff had happened earlier in this volume than I thought happened later.
Brian Hurt, yeah, that's interesting, right? Because didn't you find that the inking made a big difference? Like, between Brian Lee O'Malley and Kristen Norrie, I much prefer Kristen Norrie's inking of Brian Hurt's art.
Yeah, I feel like O'Malley was on there as a
little rough.
A stopgap. Like they were like, we need somebody to do this issue. Can you do it? It's not as... I'm trying to look and see which is the first one was.
It's a bit sketchy.
Plus he kept drawing Toronto nightclubs in the background, and I thought that was just...
Yeah, the lines are definitely much heavier on the O'Malley stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a little more fine on the Norrie stuff.
Yeah, cleaner and I think a bit more precise.
Well, that holds. If you've ever seen Christine Norrie's artwork compared to Brian Lee O'Malley's, it's all right there. So it's just, again, it's just a, one way or the other. It's funny, like, I'm looking at, but if you look at in that same scene or in that same story arc, there's the scene from the Afghanistan football stadium where they actually see the woman in the middle, which is like ripped from the headlines. But that's a really well drawn bit.
I was very preoccupied reading this without context with whether or not 9/11 had happened when a lot of it had been written.
No.
I didn't think so, but like he mentions the Taliban, I think. He was aware
of that stuff, though, before everyone else was.
Yeah, I mean, I can't because I remember I used to be aware of the Taliban, too, on a kind of a cartoon level, because they would do those, like, they'd blow up the Buddha and they'd confiscate audio tapes at the border and make them into fencing and things like that. And like back before 9/11, it was like, oh, those wacky Taliban. But then, of course, afterwards, not so much. But then I read this and I was like,
No, this was written before that, but I think, but it, like, it was mid-series. I think that the Fernandez arc was coming out when 9/11 happened, or maybe it was even in the middle of.
It's referenced, so I think it happened maybe between
At one point it's post 9/11, so.
They had to deal with it in the book, which must have completely changed what he was dealing with, because all of a sudden these characters' lives would change too, which is kind of interesting. But also it worked, it was organic enough.
Yeah.
You know something that bothered me throughout this entire book and only gets worse in the following volumes? It isn't so much in the first couple, but after a while there are massive lettering problems.
I thought we weren't going to talk about the next two volumes.
We're not, but I'm talking because it starts in this one and I'm going to ruin this book for you because you will never be able to read it without seeing these. The rule is a word balloon has a tail, and that tail is going to point at the mouth of the character who's talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Start flipping through this, and you find later on how many tails come from people's belts and their shoulders and the top of their heads. And
yeah, I did notice that.
It's the same letter all the way through.
I'm looking at one right now.
And it's perfect in the first arc. And then at some point, they just decide it doesn't matter anymore. And I could not get over it. It was driving me crazy. If the writing wasn't so good and I didn't like the whole thing, like I would have been like, what? I was this close to like sending a letter to Oni be like, I will re-letter these books. I'm not even very good at it. But let me fix these because it's driving me freaking crazy.
There's one good example of lettering, though, I think, in the next volume, though, because I think that there's a change. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, mostly it's really weird. Like, there's sometimes where there's a group of three, and I wasn't sure which character it was pointing to.
Right. Like it would be,
so that's a problem. But I mean, I could guess, but, like, I had to pause for a minute, and, you don't want to do that.
But it's just that there was no reason to. Like, I'm looking at these balloons on different pages, and the Fernandez arc is really bad, much worse than anything else. But, like, people's shoulders will be talking, the words will be coming out of the top of their head, like, when they could be coming out of the mouth. And it was, oh, God. Sorry.
Not quite Mark Trail level bad, but still pretty
bad. No. And
you ever see that comic strip in the newspaper? You remember newspapers?
Not for a long time.
Yeah. So, like, there'll be a picture. Two people will be talking, and then they'll cut to, like, there's a squirrel outside. And the guy just, I guess, decides he wants to draw a squirrel or something. But all the word balloons look like they're coming out of the squirrel's tail. The next time you happen to find a newspaper that some old person bought, take a look at the.
Do they still print those?
For the next couple of weeks.
Okay. All right. Get on that.
The New York Times and DC Comics, apparently.
So anything to add to the wonder that is Greg Rucka's Queen and Country, the book that made Chris Neesman into a stalker?
Is that what did it?
I'm pretty sure.
I would definitely recommend picking up this first volume. It's a nice fat book. You get a ton of information for $20. It looks pretty, and you get a like nice little insight into another kind of a comic book. I mean, this isn't my usual chosen genre, and I bought it a while ago, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's actually an important note, is that like there's no fantasy going on in this at all. It's all real life, and for some people that's not their cup of tea,
and not even just even these their personal lives. It's very real life. It's very crap and boring and unpleasant, and they don't eat right and they drink too much and they don't sleep enough and they're stressed and they fuck the wrong people, and everything about it is gritty and unpleasant,
but it's not done in that sort of we'll call it like an overly Hollywood style of those sorts of behaviors. Not like a rock star does it.
It's
not,
very
not like the not like the Nick Nolte character.
Yeah.
It's like you do it. You come home. You really should go to sleep, but you stay awake watching infomercials and drinking. It's just very basic and raw, and it's enjoyable because of that.
Do you feel like you get a window into Sonya's world every time she does one of these?
A little bit.
I really hardly drink anymore.
Oh, good.
Just because it isn't happening now doesn't mean it's not relevant to your life experience.
I don't know what you mean.
Revisiting this volume, I remembered that when I read it, I thought, this is amazing. And now I'm trying to figure out why I never bought volume two.
So you would call this an amazing book? Like, how do you rank this?
No, I really liked it a lot. It's outside the realm of 70% of what I buy on a given Wednesday,
It's because it's outside the realm of 90% of what's available.
Right, exactly. And, I it scratches an itch that nothing else really scratches, and I'm trying, like, for the life of me, I don't know why I didn't rush out the next day and get volume two, much less not having done it 6 months later. I think what it was the last book on my stack, and I was so goddamn proud to not have another book on that stack. I was like, I'm never buying anything again.
I've completed reading for my life.
You know what you should do? You should go to the iFanboy site, click on the store, and buy it through Amazon through that link.
I don't want to put any food in those people's mouths, frankly. No, that's a great idea. No, that's a great idea. That's maybe I will. Sonia, tell me more.
One of the other things, and this is totally like not even about the story, but like the book is really nice. Like for whatever reason, I've got a lot of trade paperbacks. This one I've read a bunch of times. I'm flipping through it. Like the paper's really nice. I don't feel like the spine is going to fall apart. It's actually
I lend this to people. This is one of those, you don't think you like comics. Why don't you try this? It's just a good spy novel.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like a novel. It's less intimidating. Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been packing house this weekend, so I've had an opportunity to get intimate with every friggin' book I own in the last couple of days. And
did you get intimate with them, really? Did you?
Well,
you know, I didn't do
you
it.
You know, the paper stock that they – no. This volume, every time I pick it up, I'm holding it in my hands right now going, God, I wish that if I could buy like 12 issues of Guardians of the Galaxy this way, you know what I mean? Like this is one of my preferred formats for how I would like it.
It's the perfect size. Any smaller than this and you start to lose something, but it works really well.
You start to feel like an 11-year-old Japanese girl.
Yes, exactly.
Last page first.
And I keep trying to read it from the back and then it makes no sense. Yeah. Word balloons or no. This book to me, I mean, it's a giant influence on me. Like these are the kinds of stories that I would want to write. I always gravitate towards working on stuff that is real as opposed to not, I guess. It's also really intimidating because he had to make sure that he was being relatively factually accurate.
Yeah.
Which is always scary, but
I don't think I could write a book like this because I don't think I would have this. A, I wouldn't have the stomach for the research, and B, I'd be too paranoid about getting things wrong.
See, I think you probably know most of this stuff. You're an informed dude. You knew who the Taliban was before 9/11. Come on.
Well,
everybody knew who the Taliban was.
I believe you're giving the benefit of the doubt to a lot of people who don't deserve it just then.
Okay, now this is the thing. Politically, for the rest of the world, 9/11 was seen differently from the way
it was. This is so not something we need to talk about right now on this show.
I'm just saying.
I'm going to cut the fuck out of it. Listen, don't even.
Okay, but I'm telling you, the comic deals with this really sensibly, and I just think it's really sensitively done. I think the difference in the way it was perceived from people who were political from the bulk of the country is dealt with very sensitively in the book, and I really appreciate that. And it shows how much research he must have done to do this.
But the other side of it being that it's very much preaching to the choir. I think the people who bought this were already the people who were amenable.
Well, maybe now that it's such an accessible volume, people who might not have picked it up before will pick it up and be able to get that out of it.
Do one or more of you read this and watch the show 24 by any chance?
I can't watch 24. I watched the first season of it, and because of this, like, it's lame.
This is the crux of my question.
Have you ever seen MI5 or Spooks, as they call it in the UK?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. That is closer to this, very much so. It's actually a really good show. Don't watch the ones that they rerun here because they cut the hell out of them and they're edited all weird. But that is the closest that you can get to this. I prefer this because that's a little more stylistic, but that's a really good show. And it deals with a lot of the same issues because they're MI5, so they're domestic as opposed to MI6, who are international. But
And for the bureaucracy, I would actually I'd recommend like the original State of Play miniseries.
That's on my
It's very good.
I've been pondering whether to go show or movie with that because I'm not watching both. I got places to be.
Go with the miniseries. You got always, the Bill Nye in there, so
always go with the miniseries.
Yeah,
whenever you can, and you can also check out. I think Sandbaggers is out on DVD now.
Cool. Really
like I don't know how to feel about the newfound knowledge that this book is based on something. Like, I liked it a little better when I thought it sprung whole cloth from the mind.
Right, but that show is also 30 years old and no one would have known about it, so I think he took it and liked, he's like, I like this. This is men smoking and it's Tweety, And
honestly, there are no new ideas. You can't. You're younger than us, Paul. But someone just taking an idea and molding it and making it into something truly beautiful is a great thing to do.
I think Paul's going to try to challenge you on that for his.
Whole well, he's younger than me. No. I think well, he can't.
No, he's lost that one. But.
but there are no new ideas, really.
Yeah.
That's just got to appreciate the people who are honing the things that exist.
The sound you just heard was me deleting every text file on my hard drive. In sadness.
Why?
Because it's all been done. What's the point?
Well, this is why I'm not an artist. It's depressing.
Here's my thing. No, like creativity isn't about making something out of nothing. It's about taking what resources you have and making the best, you know, thing you can make out of the best product, whether it's a story or interpretation, right? So yes. It's pulling from all the different things, like things that have inspired you or, you know, different little ideas you've had all coming together. So it's, you know, we're just making collages. That's what creativity is.
You know, for me, reading Queen and Country, this is a book that doesn't. There's no other books like this. There's not books that survive like this. They tried. Image had that series, The Circle, that nobody bought. It was by Brian Reed. He writes for Marvel.
Reed,
people know.
Yeah.
And it's like it's so good that I still don't know why they don't try to do more stories like this in comics, other than the fact that people don't buy them. Which is raw, which is, you know, it's too bad. There's no reason that if you could do this as a TV show, you should be able to do it as a comic. And this is a really successful version of that. You know, it's a little.
But gotta put Spider-Man, Spider-Woman in it if you're going to do that.
What I say is if you read this book and you love it, you should tell it about everybody about it and they can and give it to people and let people borrow it. And they'll say, wow, there are different kinds of stories. You don't have to put fantasy. You don't have to put magic or supernatural or zombies in a book to make it compelling and to make it a good comic book.
Yeah, such is the heft of this volume that you could actually forcibly throw this through someone's windshield or window and force them to read it. So I think you should take advantage of that.
Absolutely. All right, well, thanks very much. If you want to talk more about this book, you can go to the thread on ifanboy.com. You can always write to us at contact@ifanboy.com. And just make sure you check this book out. It is one of my favorites. It's a five-star book, I'd say.
Five stars, yeah.
Five stars. Four and a half, Sonia. Three.
Oh, I just don't think about things like that. I'm not going to give it stars. It's just good. It's a good, solid book.
Not going to give it stars. Well, I'm going
to. She does astronomy.
She doesn't understand the comic reader's mentality at all.
No, I really don't.
I'm not trying to talk to you in your language. I'm trying to translate.
Right.
You don't understand.
Sonia, just exclaim that it's the best book ever and be done with it.
No, it's not. It's a good, solid book.
Do it. All right.
Talk about what two movies it crosses. It's Men in Black meets Daddy Daycare.
Oh
my God, yes.
Please stop.
By the way, I think Paul and I have a pitch to work on just now.
Yes.
Right. I think that's clearly what's happening. All right, thanks very much. We'll talk to you later.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over. In your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it, and sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.